Now, detonate the reality bomb!
I will build a great, great wall.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The truth is out there.
The military-industrial complex.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know.
Change has come to America.
Catapult of propaganda.
From a secure location on top of the ridge in the heart of the beautiful Missouri Ozarks, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
If you watch this program for any length of time, you know by now that I profess a belief in a pre-tribulation rapture. So why, might you ask, am I inviting a partial preterist onto the program? Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. The reason is because, as the Bible tells us, that even the apostles didn't quite understand the prophecies of Jesus' first coming. They were still asking him 40 days after the resurrection if he was about to establish the kingdom in Israel. Paul wrote to the church at Corinth and told them that the archons, the rulers of the age, didn't understand the nature of the Messiah's arrival, or they wouldn't have crucified him. So is it possible that us pre-tribulationists don't have all the answers? We're welcoming a gentleman who's using fiction to present a case for the partial preterist view of Bible prophecy. He's an award-winning Hollywood scriptwriter and the author of some fiction that we highly recommend, The Chronicles of the Nephilim, Chronicles of the Watchers. His new series is Chronicles of the Apocalypse, and just out now, book two, Remnant, Rescue of the Elect. We welcome Brian Kadawa back to the program. Brian, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Derek. Thanks for having me on. Man, I really do appreciate your graciousness because, as you know, in the futurist camp, which is, you know, that's how I kind of, that's how your camp would be defined, which includes right. Pre-trib, post-trib, mid-trib, all that. It's futurist. And whereas preterist tends to mean past. Mm-hmm. And there are different versions of preterism as well. But we are often considered, you know, the retarded stepbrother in the closet or or the heretic by futurists sometimes, sadly,
right.
You know.
In fact, so Josh Peck told me I should introduce you as a dirty partial preterist in order to make that point clear.
I don't know what that, wait, what does that mean?
Well, you know, it's Josh. He's a kid. What does he know?
Yes. Oh, gotcha.
We're still trying. We're still working with him. You know, Sharon and I are sort of like the grandparents here at Skywatch TV and around the office.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah, Josh
that
and
dirty
Christina.
Partial preterist.
That's right. He said that with a smile, though, so you can take that for what it's worth. But you're right. There seems to be a lot of a lot more, shall we say, vitriol in the camp, and we're dealing with issues now that have been debated amongst Christians and our Jewish brothers and sisters for 2,600 years. You know, I gave a presentation at the recent prophecy conference in Oklahoma City or Norman, Oklahoma, on the Gog-Magog conflict, Ezekiel 38:39. Now, he wrote that in the 6th century BC, and people are still trying to figure out what exactly he meant. Who is Gog? Is it Turkey? Is it Russia? Is it something else? Are they maybe coming from the North Pole? What does uttermost parts of the North really mean? Where is Cush? Who's Rosh? You know, is Rosh even a thing? So, you know, we still haven't figured it out, so we're not going to settle this over the course of the next 45 minutes to an hour. But again, because Paul, and I give credit to Dr. Michael Heiser for pointing this out in his book, Unseen Realm. When Paul said to the church at Corinth, look, the rulers of this age, the rulers of the world, archons, supernatural entities, the principalities and powers, couldn't figure it out because if they had, they wouldn't have crucified Jesus because that's just what he needed. That's what he wanted them to do. That's probably why he provoked a fight by going up to Mount Hermon for the transfiguration. Here I am, come get some. And they did. And then, lo and behold, we're saved. So,
and on that, we agree. So you're right.
Right.
Yeah, I do. I think that I think it behooves all of us to, no matter what view you have. And by the way, I've been all the views. I started out as a classic dispensationalist, born, raised and bred on Hal Lindsey. And as years went on,
for getting people excited about Bible prophecy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and quite frankly, you know, I will admit that when I first became that dispensationalist, you know, my context was definitely the Lord's coming back, but are you ready to face judgment? You know, and the gospel was my whole purpose to share with people. And I think that with many futurists, it is. And I became a premillennialist and then amillennialist. And now here I end up as a preterist. And what I've learned through the years is to remain humble and acknowledge that I think we all need to like you said, well, you know, we're going to have firm convictions about what we believe things are. But I do think we have to be willing to at least be willing to discuss with each other like we're doing now. And I thank you. I appreciate it because I'm actually amazed at how many podcasters really are willing to have me on and talk about the issue. It's encouraging. Let me put it that way. Mm. And don't get me wrong. I'm not a victim. We're not like this persecuted minority class at all, because in fact, what I would argue is this recent decade, and I think on into the future, there's been an increase of more scholarly interest in preterism, more well-known scholars, whether it's R.C. Sproul and Hank Hanegraaff and other guys. Well-respected evangelical theologians are coming into the camp of preterism. It seems to be on the rise. Actually, that's the thing I've been surprised at, how many podcasters are already in my partial preterist camp. I'm trying to get on, you know, promotion and get the word out. And I find more and more, you know, about half of the guys I'm contacting are also partial preterists. I'm not expecting that. So, it's a reality that we need to deal with, and we need to be fair with each other, you mm-hmm. know? So that would be my plea to my futurist brothers. And so thank you again for at least for, you know, you're giving me, not a voice, but a platform to be able to share. And I know that most of your audience is not going to agree with this. So you almost think, well, why bother? Who's going to buy my books? That's okay. I would only say this, launching into the Chronicles of the Apocalypse. I really did write this series. I call it the origin story of the Book of Revelation. So I'm actually writing about during the time when John was writing the Book of Revelation, and we're talking about the first century after the Book of Acts, a time period that a lot of Christians don't know a lot about, and that's right. This time period from around 30 AD to 70 AD. And there's this massive event that Josephus, the ancient Jewish historian, wrote about, and it's the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple by the Roman armies of Titus in 70 AD. And that was all – that sort of that was launched by this Jewish revolt in AD 66 or so. And this is an event that has far more importance than I think most Christians realize. So my goal is to I'm embodying my personal view of Revelation in the story, but it's highly researched, as researched as a Gilbert book, and footnoted, I might add. I have a novel that's footnoted because I know Christians are going to go like, where did he get this, right? So my goal was to tell this story of this, you know, 7-year period or so where the revolt, actually the great fire started in Rome, and Nero blames on the Christians, and then we have the Neronic persecution, right, where he throws into the lions and all that. And this ultimately leads up to this massive battle of, you know, Titus against Jerusalem. And so I tell that whole story with the historical context in mind, and I try to be very accurate historically, only because I know that if I'm going to claim that some of these things are fulfilling Bible prophecy, well, then I've got to be honest about that, you know, honest and fair. So my goal is that even if you don't have this viewpoint, I honestly believe it'll entertain you, it'll give you an idea of what those of us may believe, and you'll still gain a lot of historical understanding. And by the way, I might add, there is the continuing, shall I say, divine counsel worldview that I bring in. So I'm dealing with spiritual warfare, the spiritual powers, just like I did in Chronicles and the Nephilim, and just like you and I do agree upon, you know, this notion of the, you know, the spiritual powers and the Heiserian worldview, you know, if I could say that with a laugh.
Well, we have a bell that we ring on Sunday mornings when Sharon and I record our weekly Bible study. Every time we make a Heiser reference, and there's not a week that goes by that we don't ring the virtual bell. So Without giving away too much of the plot, obviously the destruction of Jerusalem being one of the key events in Remnant Rescue of the Elect, what other characters do you use and why did you choose them?
Yeah, so my story throughout the whole series, like you said, I'm on the second book now, but I'm basically following a Christian, a Jew, and a Roman. And I put them all together in that this Roman is actually a prefect in Rome who is given the task from Nero to hunt down this subversive letter that he's heard about that's talking about the end of the world and destruction of Rome and stuff. And because he thinks it's an assassination ploy against him, and he's paranoid, right? Nero's paranoid. So he sends this Roman, and this Roman prefect is kind of like an epic journey. And the Roman prefect has a Jewish doctor who has been his personal doctor, and the Jew does not, you know, he does it because he has to, right? But he's also a man who's learned how to survive and compromise. And then in the purge, great purge of the Christians, they end up capturing a woman who's a Christian, and she becomes their servant. And it so happens that she actually had been involved with the Apostle Paul. And so in the first book, we meet all these characters and set them up. Excuse me. And in the second book, excuse me. So by the end of the second book, they've discovered the pieces of this letter because it's been cut up. And obviously there are other copies of it, but it's one of the things that the Christians do is because they know it's subversive, they chip it up into pieces and so that no one can have the whole thing type of thing. At least in Rome, that's what they're doing, and in Asia Minor. So at the end of that book, they found out who's written it and where he is, and it's the Apostle John. So book two, Remnant, Rescue the Elect, begins with them actually getting to the island of Patmos and talking to the Apostle John. But there's a lot more to it than just information. There's a lot of tricks going on and a lot of problems because the Roman is not a Christian. And he's still dangerous, and we don't know if he's going to try to execute John or what have you. And so that's sort of the launch of that story. And the reason why it's titled Remnant Rescue of the Elect is because of this. We all know about the 144,000 in the book of Revelation. And my understanding interpretation of that is that that is actually this opens a can of worms, I know.
I was going to ask you about that, so I'm glad you're bringing it up.
Yeah. So my understanding of the book of Revelation is I don't believe that it was written about the future end of the world. I think it was mostly focused on this destruction that was coming as the ending of the old covenant. In other words, the old covenant was still technically in place, even though the new covenant had been inaugurated, because the temple, which is the embodiment of the old covenant, was still standing. And so part of the purpose was to warn the fact that because the Jews rejected Messiah, Jesus, like he said in Matthew 23 and 24, he's going to judge them for rejecting Messiah. He's going to destroy their house, the temple. And this is part of two things: judging those who rejected Messiah, the first century, by the way, and the first century generation. And then secondly, to finalize his, let's put it this way, historically vindicate what God had already begun or inaugurated with at the cross. And that's from my perspective, that's the main purpose of Revelation. So that's why I see, Revelation doesn't just talk to seven churches. It does, Revelation is written to the seven churches in Asia Minor, and those were literal churches in that time period, and it's very relevant to them. But then after that point, futurists tend to believe that then the rest of it's in the future. But I believe that no, it continues to talk about what's going to happen that hadn't happened yet, which was the destruction of the temple. So when we get to the 144,000, I basically believe that those are Jewish Christians, Jews who believed, who are the ones who would be rescued who would leave the city of Jerusalem before the destruction occurred. And this is why, you know, Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation, flee to the mountains. These are the Christians that did that. So yes, I do believe 144,000 is symbolic. 12 apostles times the 12 patriarchs or what have you, times the 12 tribes. And 12,000 out of each tribe is not literal. It's a symbolic number of times 1,000, which is 1,000 is 1,000 in the Bible is the number of completed perfection. So I see, you know, and I know there are different versions. Some people think it's literal. Maybe it's close. I don't know at the time period, but I think it was basically symbolic, and the symbolism had to do with those whom God had placed his seal upon, and those are the ones that didn't want Jewish Christians to suffer the wrath that was coming upon the Jewish unbelievers who rejected him. Mm. And then, you know, and the 144,000 is first introduced in Revelation 7. And then after that, it talks about, you know, the great multitude of Gentiles who believe, right? So that's kind of the gospel connection there, Gentiles and Jews being one. Mm. That's roughly what it is. And so my story in Remnant is this trio of people end up in Jerusalem, and through various plot twists, they're trying to persuade the Christians, because they hadn't got the letter yet, and they're trying to get persuade them that this letter is real, and a lot of the Christians don't believe them, because as we know, the Bible talks about how there was a big problem in the early church of Judaizers who would say that you can believe in Jesus, but you also had to follow the law of Moses.
Right, right.
And yeah, so these were guys who were saying the temple's not going to be destroyed. God wouldn't do that kind of thing. So it's all about them trying to persuade the Christians, and it gets too late, and a massive problem occurs. I'm not going to reveal all the plot twists, but something occurs where it looks like they're really not going to make it. And so the question is, how are they going to get out of it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the scenario that I'm depicting, and it's only the second book, and there's going to be two more, so there's a lot more to come. But the time period that I'm in terms of the history part, what I'm telling is, this occurs sometime around, it starts around, the revolt starts, the Jewish revolt starts around AD 66, and Titus doesn't come till AD 67. So this is right before Titus comes. What Nero does first is he sends Cestius Gallus, who is the governor of Syria. He sends him in with an army, and it's not as huge of an army, but he thinks it's not going to be that big of a deal. And so Cestius actually surrounds Jerusalem, and there's some battles that go on there. And this was an event that occurred before the big battle began, if I can put it that way, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting because what happened was that Cestius was surrounding Jerusalem. And he could have he actually had almost broken through the doors of the temple itself. And for a mysterious reason, nobody knows, Josephus says it's a mystery, he just all of a sudden pulled out. And he was on the verge of taking the temple. And, you know, I think there might be a spiritual thing going on there.
Sure,
so
sure.
I bring that into the story as well. But so, yeah, it's a fascinating thing that a fascinating aspect of history, and that's kind of what Remnant is about.
You've written a nonfiction book dealing with Matthew 24, and of course Matthew 24 talks about the abomination of desolation, warning those in Judea to flee to the mountains, let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in the house, let the one in the field not turn back to take his cloak, etc. But when you get to verse 29, I want to get your take on this. Verse 29 reads, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in the heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, that's a verse that many of us who are futurists will look to and say, well, see, that hasn't been fulfilled yet, so the other stuff which immediately preceded verse 29 must not have happened yet either. So how do you address that?
Yeah. So, stop me and interrupt me if I filibuster, because there's a lot here, of course.
And well, because you read the whole book on it, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But I recognize part of the biggest problem, I think we talked about this last time, is the paradigm issue, where it's very hard for different paradigms to really, you know, we start looking at specific details, and both sides are going to have, it's not just that we have an interpretation of this one thing, it's connected, it's a big network of beliefs that are all connected. So it's very easy for us to go, and that leads to this, and that leads to this. So, you know, I'll try to be simple, at least introductory, to kind of give a smattering. But in the book, you're right, End Times Bible Prophecy, I do give a lot of scriptural basis, and I'm not the kind of guy that can, like, rattle off Bible verses. I have to have my notes here, you know, to look at, and I forget which verses they are. So, but the short of it is I too, by the way, when I first became a preterist, I started going through Matthew 24, and I was looking at a lot of the things made sense. You know, you will be brought before kings and governors, and it's like, yeah, the apostles were, and, you know, there were famines and earthquakes, and yeah, those occurred. But then when I got to this passage, that was my big wall. But come on, that's obviously the second coming of Christ. Well, now, believe it or not, after studying particularly this coming on the clouds is I think one of the key issues. But now, having studied this imagery, this metaphor of coming on the clouds in the Old Testament, I now believe this is one of the easiest things to prove, only because I'm in the school that stresses we must not impose our Western mind upon the Old Testament or the New Testament text.
Sure.
We should seek to understand through their context. And their context would be Jews who are steeped in the Old Testament. So if they're going to be writing these images, it behooves us to look and see, well, is there precedent? And sure enough, in the prophecies of the Old Testament, there's lots of precedents of this imagery. I'll start back. I won't start with the coming. I'll just start with sun dark and the moon and the stars falling from heaven. And, you know, I used to always think that that was literal astronomical phenomenon. And by the way, they did believe an astronomical phenomenon were reflective of things going on Earth.
Right.
But as you and I know, there's this more a deeper connection between the stars of heaven and the gods, right?
Right.
And the ancient Jews believed that the earthly powers were linked to heavenly powers. And so whatever happened on earth also happened in heaven, right? And so this goes all throughout the Old Testament. And so there's two aspects of this that I believe is going on with the stars falling from the skies and such astronomical effects. And basically what it is I think a description of whenever God judges a people, a nation, or a city, in the Old Testament, he uses this same language over and over again to describe the fall of their authority and powers. And one could argue that it's a reference to the spiritual powers. That's fine. But I think I certainly think it's both. You know, in other words, you know, this nation, this Babylon is falling. So the stars are falling from the sky because both its spiritual powers and its earthly powers are being crushed. Let me just give you a couple examples so you know where I'm getting this from. It's not out of the blue. Classic. In fact, I think the very Jesus almost quotes from Isaiah 13. And in Isaiah 13, from like 1 till about, you know, gosh, I don't know, verse 19, I won't read the whole thing, but he's describing the destruction of Babylon by the Medes, which happened in 539 BC. So we know this did happen. And the description he uses is as if it's a destruction of the heavens and the earth. And so he talks about the Oracle of Babylon. He says, the Lord is coming. He will make the earth a desolation. Really? The whole earth? Did that happen already? He will exterminate the sinners, for the stars of the heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will shed its light. But he keeps going on and he says, the heavens will tremble. I will punish the world for its evil. It sounds like it's universal cataclysm, right? But of course, that didn't happen in history. And I would argue why he's using this language metaphorically. And, you know, I can go over multiple passages. So he's using the language metaphorically, but here's why. Because to the ancient world, they used astronomical language as an expression of their covenants. So in other words, the covenants with their gods were so important that it was described as the creation of the heavens and the earth. When God made a covenant, it was like creating the heavens and the earth, right? So when he covenantally interacts with a nation, even a pagan nation, right? There, it's a cataclysmic, it's a cosmic catastrophe, because that's how they understood covenants. And I'll just give one more example. I won't go details, but this is really important, because in Jeremiah 4, again, you got to read the whole chapter, because there's a lot of this stuff. When God destroyed the first temple, even when he was dealing with Israel, in 587 BC, God destroys the first temple. And here's what Jeremiah describes it. He says, I looked in the earth. Behold, it was formless and void.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. The whole earth was put back to Genesis 1 before formless and void. And to the heavens, they had no light. The mountains were quaking. The hills, there was no man, no birds, no fruit. You read through the whole passage. Basically what you find there is he's reversing Genesis 1. It's like he's saying the earth is put back to void. There's no man, no vegetable, or no foliage, no animals, which is a reversal of creation. So what he's saying is God's covenant with his people, particularly rooted in the temple, which is the embodiment of the covenant, is so important that when that is destroyed, that's like the heavens and the earth being destroyed. You see? So when I go back to Matthew 24, then I read that and I see, well, look, even if you're a futurist, by the way, I was a futurist when I first came to this realization. So you don't have to be a preterist to acknowledge that the astronomical phenomenon is primarily a description of the spiritual seriousness of the historical circumstance that's happening. So, like I said, that's preterist or futurist, it could be the same thing. And then you get to then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. There's a question in that text, grammatically, is it that there will that the Son of Man will appear in heaven, or there will be a sign that appears that proves the Son of Man is in heaven? I'm not a Greek guy, but I've just read the scholars, and they've said that it's kind of ambiguous. I understand this as being, he's saying the sign will appear that the Son of Man is in heaven. And why do I think that? Because all throughout the Gospels, what did Jesus tell the leaders of Israel? He's like, let me see if I can find a good passage. I think it's Matthew 16. So Matthew 16, 27, 28, So Jesus is there. He's talking to his disciples. He says, for the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in glory. And truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in the kingdom.
Right, right.
There are some standing here who will not die. And then there's another passage where Jesus is talking to the high priest, and the high priest says, I adjure you by the living God, tell us, are you the Christ? He's trying to challenge him to kill him with his words, right? And Jesus says, yes, I am. So you say that I am. And he says that, and you will, from now on, you will see the Son of Man coming in power and glory, seated at the right hand of the Father. And so this notion of the temple being destroyed was the sign that proved to the Jews who rejected him that he was the Messiah. He was seated at the right hand of God, and he was destroying their old covenant to replace it with a new covenant. So that's what that's how I see the sign in Matthew 24.
And I will say this, one of the things that I've learned in researching the book, The Great Inception, was, as you say, the importance of these bodies in the sky to the people of ancient Mesopotamia. The sun god Shamash was the lawgiver. He was the one who handed the law to Hammurabi for his famous law code. Hammurabi, of course, was the first great king of Babylon, which, of course, is the symbol of occult wickedness until the end of time. Mystery Babylon the Great. The moon god was the one. And in fact, I'm going to write a book on this. The moon god is far more important in the ancient world, especially to the Amorites, who were the founders of Babylon, than we've ever known. In fact, where did Moses get the law? He got it on Mount Sinai. Well, Sinai, according to scholars, and this isn't Derek making this up, this goes back more than 100 years, scholars have known that Sinai is actually based on the name of the moon god, Sin, in the wilderness of
interesting
Sin. And the first place that the Israelites attacked was Jericho, which was the city of the moon god, because that was the Amorite name for the moon god, Yarik. So, and then you've got the stars. And the cosmic triad is a symbol you see in a lot of those ancient texts, where you've got the sun, the moon, the crescent moon, and then you've got another star. Well, that's Venus. That's Inanna, Ishtar, Ashtoreth in the Bible. Who was a thorn in the side of the Israelites and the priests for hundreds and hundreds of years. Josiah, when he had his great reform and cleaned up Judah, the kingdom of Judah, he had to literally tear down the houses of the male cult prostitutes of Ashtoreth in the temple, in Solomon's temple. They had houses for the male cult prostitutes. So again, you've got sun, moon, stars. Again, it's that cosmic triad that goes all the way back to ancient Sumer, but was especially important after the foundation of the Kingdom of Babylon.
Yeah. And like I said, they did believe in astronomical, astrological, literal, in other words, I'm not saying it's just always metaphorical, but this case, you find the language repeating in prophecies in situations where I don't think you could argue that it did happen literally back then, because if the sky rolled up like a scroll in Isaiah back then, well, then that would have been a huge wormhole that destroyed everything. So obviously, I would say in those cases, in terms of the prophetic cases, they're talking about the spiritual powers, mm-hmm. and they're using the astronomical as a metaphor for
right.
them.
Right. Well, and the coming on the clouds, and we've talked before, the coming on the clouds is a reversal or a polemic against the way the storm god Baal was described, and that was the other child of the moon god. In Mesopotamian cosmology, the moon god was the father of the sun god, the storm god, and Venus, Ishtar, Inanna. So
go ahead.
I was going to say, you've got all four of that sort of cosmic pagan quartet there in Matthew 24, 29, and 30.
Now, the next step is, in a way, you've kind of already introduced the notion of coming on the clouds. I think the reason why this is now the easiest to me is because when I studied it, there's so many passages in the Old Testament that talk about whenever God judges a city, a nation, or a people, it's described in the Old Testament as Yahweh coming on the clouds. So you read in Isaiah 19:1, the oracle concerning Egypt, when God judged Egypt in 701 BC, behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt. When he judges Nineveh through Babylon, in Nahum 1, 2 through 3, it says, the Lord takes vengeance, his way is whirlwind and storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet.
Right, right.
And it goes on, there's a dozen of these passages, and I'm like, oh, well, did Yahweh literally come surfing in on a cumulus nimbus? No, this is language of deity. Only deity is on the clouds, and we go back to Daniel 7, right, where the Son of Man comes on a cloud up to God as the judge. He's the judge, and it involves judgment. And so whenever God judges, that's the language he uses. So we jump back to Matthew 24, and the context, at least, there's this. We have to pull back and say, well, okay, if we look at this verse individually, we can interpret it as anything. But if you pull back, the context, I would argue, is Matthew 23. Where Jesus talks about, you first century Jews are going to reject Messiah, and you're all guilty. All the blood of all the prophets are on you. That's pretty big, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm going to leave your house desolate. I'm going to destroy it. Why? Because you it's not God's house anymore. It's your house, and God's going to destroy it. And then in Matthew 23, he says, all these things will happen to this generation. And then he describes what those things are, right? And, futurists would tend to say, well, this is some future generation that sees these things or whatever. But when I studied where all this generation, everywhere Jesus used it, everywhere in the New Testament, it always meant the people to whom he was talking. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but interestingly, it's pretty much always used in the context of judgment. He says a wicked generation, this generation is wicked for accepting a sign, and this generation shall be compared to Sodom and Gomorrah. So whenever he's talking about this generation, it's usually judgment. Mm. So he's going to judge this first generation. That was an interesting context to me. And then secondly, so in the beginning of Matthew 23, That's Matthew 23, for those who want to know, 36. That's where he says all these things will come. Then he describes all these things, including the cloud coming. And then at the very end, he says, he wraps it up with the bookend. He says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So it's like he's giving a sermon and he's bookending it with the same statement. So everything between those two statements, in my from my perspective, hermeneutically, has to be interpreted as being fulfilled within that generation, including the cloud coming, which is why I believe that the cloud coming is not necessarily the second coming of Christ to all the earth, but this is the cloud, the judgment coming of Christ on Israel. There are different prayers who believe differently. They believe that is the second coming, and that's all there is. But I'm not in that camp. But here's the other interesting element that sort of reinforces it. That's the verse where he says, then all the tribes of the earth will mourn.
Right.
And that's something that has a lot more behind it than people realize. So I got to look up my little Bible verse here. So the Greek word for earth is gi. Now, it can be translated earth, but when I think that that's a bad English word to use, because when we moderns see the word earth, what do we think of? We think of the globe. But it usually didn't mean that. It usually meant the earth, as in dirt, terra firma. Sometimes it meant, as you know, the land as far as they knew, as far as they could see. But it wasn't this notion of a globe. And secondly, the word is often and better translated as land. And the reason why that's important is when you're telling Jews, the tribes of the land will mourn. That's a little different meaning than the tribes of the earth, which is kind of interesting because it's kind of the opposite meaning. Most people would say tribes of the earth. That's everyone.
Sure.
But I would argue, oh, it's better translated tribes of the land, and that's always meant Israel. And that has a very fascinating connection to Revelation. Because I'm going to have an article out soon where I said one little word changes everything in the book of Revelation, and that word is the word earth. And so a lot of times we read Revelation and I understand why we think this has got to be the end of the world, because you know, the tribes of the earth, all the earth, right? But if you understand that it's probably better translated as land, and not just arbitrarily. I mean, I can go through verses and show you where it should be translated land. And this one verse is, I'll give you the example. This is in the very, very beginning, Revelation 1. John is describing the reason why he's writing the book. In verse 7, he says, behold, he is coming with the clouds. There it is again. And every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will wail. And you go, well, that isn't that earthly world. Well, here's where I follow the phrase, never read a Bible verse, which means don't just read one verse, read it in context.
Right.
And always – this is always go back and look at the Old Testament that they're quoting, because they're not just quoting one verse, they're quoting a chapter, and there's a lot more in the chapter that's there. So if you go back to that, or let's see, what is that then? That is, what's the actual verse? Let me find it. Zechariah. So go back to Zechariah 12:10, and this is where he quotes it, and it says, I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem spirit of grace and pleas for mercy, so that when they look on me and whom they have pierced, they shall mourn for him as one mourns for a child. So this is to the tribes of Israel, the context of Zechariah is the tribes of Israel. Now, wherever this prophecy is fulfilled, I think we can all agree he's talking about the Jews are going to kill Messiah, their own Messiah, they're going to pierce him. Yes, the Romans crucified him, but the Jews are guilty for handing him over. They're just, you know. And they're going to mourn. Why? Because they're going to be judged for what they did, which is what happened in AD 70. So does that make some sense, at least from what I'm trying to describe here? So now you go back to Revelation 1:7, and you see all the tribes of the earth should be all the tribes of the land. And if that is a guiding opener for the rest of the book, which I would argue it is, because that's sort of like, this is the purpose of my letter, you know, now go back and read all these things through Revelation where you read earth, put in land, and you might see a very different interpretation, which is the picture of mine is, you know, the beast doesn't just come out from the earth. The beast comes up from the land beast comes up from the land of Israel. I can't think off the top of my head, but there's lots of these verses just put in the word land for Earth and see, you'll see a very different picture. And my what I'm arguing is that Revelation is mostly a picture of judgment on the land of Israel, and which culminates in Christ coming in the clouds and destroying the temple, and you know, the New Jerusalem then, as I see it, is a obvious symbol of the new covenant body of Christ, the bride of Christ, who God, you know, marries, you know. So that's kind of the, you know, the big sweeping thing. I know that people are probably thinking, yeah, but what about that? What about this? I get it, because I have the same issues myself. But
well, and as we said at the beginning of this program, well, yeah, it does. And at the beginning of the program, we said, you know, this is material that's been debated since John wrote the book. I mean, the early church fathers like Irenaeus were in Hippolytus, and were trying to figure out exactly what he meant. You know, almost 2,000 years ago, and when you go into the Old Testament prophecies of Zechariah, Ezekiel, Daniel, the apocalyptic prophecies, then you're adding another 600 or 700 years on top of that. So this is not something we're going to solve in the span of one podcast, but it is food for thought, and just reminds us of what Paul meant when he was telling the church at Corinth, look, the archons, these spiritual entities that have been around for millennia, didn't understand the prophecies of his first coming. We probably aren't going to understand the prophecies of his second coming any better. God is called the Lord of hosts, Lord of armies, for a reason. He's a good general, and he doesn't give away his plans before it's time to reveal them. So we pray for wisdom and understanding so that we'll recognize his work when it comes, when it happens.
Yeah, amen. And, you know, so my goal here is just to at least help Christians see, oh, it's not just this arbitrary, how can you just making it up to be whatever you want, but it's rooted in a way of seeing the scriptures and interpreting. It's at least there's a way to read these in this past interpretation, and it's not just arbitrary. It's rooted in at least scriptural exegesis that tries to make the point. Again, I have the same issue. When we're so used to one way of seeing things, it seems absurd to us to hear another viewpoint. And this is my plea. Of course, I'm in the minority view, so obviously I'm going to plead for people to listen to other views. But I've done it because I've listened to all the views, and I still do. And I read your book, for instance, The Great Inception. I loved it, right? And in fact, I used things from your book in my new series.
Sweet.
Of course, I disagreed with the second half. Okay, you're getting a little nutty now.
Yeah, well, I was speculating there, and I said
exactly.
So you know.
Yeah, but again, I read it and I enjoyed it, and I learned from you tremendously, even though we have a very different view in that end times thing, and so yeah, I guess I'm just beating a dead horse here, and I just.
Well, it's on life support. It's not dead yet, so we're okay.
Yeah, that's true. But especially in today's world, you know, there's just so much polarity, you know, in politics and society, and also in the church. And I just want us to disagree vehemently, but just be able to discuss these things.
Right.
So. Yeah. Once again, thank you.
Well, and for the record, and of course, Mike Heiser doesn't get invited to many prophecy conferences either, and his work was foundational to both of what we do. And yet the three of us and our wives will be touring Israel together next May, assuming all plans come together as we hope. So we'll have an opportunity to see some of the sites that are key in the story for the Chronicles of the Apocalypse. Things that Mike has written about in the unseen realm. We'll see Mount Hermon. We'll see an area that I'm going to be writing about more in my next book, the Gilgal Rephaim and the dolmens of the Jordan River Valley. Looking forward to all of that. The Grotto of Pan and just some other exciting things. And of course, Jerusalem itself. And don't know if we'll get up to the Temple Mount and onto the Temple Mount, but we'll pray for that as we get there. And the way the plan works out, we'll be in Jerusalem on the 70th anniversary of Israel's independence, which is going to be an historic day. Aaron Lipkin says he doesn't know what the plans are. Yeah. Well, you know, if you're going to get called home, what better place than from Jerusalem? So, you know, no.
You know,
that's literally
why I decided to do it, because I, all these years, I've been fearful, you know, of going there. And, you know, I keep hearing guys who go and they say, you have a better chance of getting shot in Chicago, you know, and I'm like, yeah, that's really true. And then, and literally just what you said, I go, you know, if we're going to die, you know, and I don't have that many years left, you know, so it's like, hey, why not do it in the Holy Land? That'd be cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're really looking forward to that. We've got people that have contacted us, by the way, Brian, from as far away as New Zealand, where two families in New Zealand are holding bake sales to raise the money so they can go on this tour. We met people at the conference in Branson, again, people at the conference in Norman, Oklahoma, who are going to be accompanying us on this tour. And we thank those folks for stepping out in faith. It's not an inexpensive tour, but it is going to be one that will be once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So we're looking forward to that and looking forward to seeing the history of the land with our own eyes. And while we're on that tour, we'll have some fascinating discussions about who's
absolutely
who's right.
About who's right. You're like, we're going to be there at McGill or whatever. And Derek's going to be saying, yeah, see, this is what's going to happen in the future. And Godow's going to say, no. You see, it happened. Here's where it happened in the past. And then Heisler's going to be, no, you're both wrong. And there's a little bit of both of you.
We made sure on the tour guide that when we go to see Megiddo, we made sure to point out that this will not be the site of the Battle of Armageddon.
and on that, we also all agree, which is really cool.
Well, the series is Chronicles of the Apocalypse. Book one is Tyrant, Rise of the Beast. Book two, Remnant, Rescue of the Elect. That is newly available. And where do people get a copy of one or both books?
Everything's on Amazon exclusively, and I actually, you know, it's ebook, it's paperback, and audiobooks of everything that I do. But if you want to find out more information about this stuff, you're like, well, I don't know, I'm not sure, go to Godawa.com. That's my name, Godawa.com. And I have click on the Chronicles of the Apocalypse link. There's lots of artwork, lots of free articles, a lot of descriptions. I cast my novels and I have pictures. So you can be more informed before you jump into it if you're curious. But there's also a lot of free articles and books. I have a scholarship link on each of my book series where I give free articles. And for the Chronicles of the Apocalypse, I even have a few classic books from my viewpoint, like The Beast of Revelation by Ken Gentry. The whole book's for free. Before Jerusalem Fell by Ken Gentry as well. This is the classic book that makes the argument that Revelation was written before AD 70, whereas a lot of futurist theologians believe Revelation was written in AD 95, which would be problematic for my view. Mm. But you can get the whole book that argues for my side of things for free. So there's a lot of free stuff there, and it'll give you a better picture if you don't want to jump into buying it right away.
Very cool. The website, Godawa.com, and again, the book, the new one, Remnant, Rescue of the Elect. Brian, always an education when we talk, and look forward to finally seeing you face-to-face come next May, if not sooner.
Amen. Thanks, Derek.
Again, Brian's website is Godawa.com, Godawa.com. You'll find links to the Chronicles of the Apocalypse series there, as well as Chronicles of the Nephilim and Chronicles of the Watchers. Again, both of those series, all three of the series, we highly recommend. It's fiction that makes you think, and the new series, Chronicles of the Apocalypse, fiction that is highly footnoted so that you can check his sources and make sure that Brian just isn't pulling stuff out of thin air, which he is not. In fact, his fiction work in the Chronicles of the Apocalypse is more highly footnoted, heavily footnoted, than some nonfiction works than I've read recently. So do want to check it out. Now, for the record, I still hold to a pre-tribulational view, and in large part because while I agree that there's some symbolism involved, a lot of symbolism involved, obviously, in apocalyptic prophecy, that still there are some physical things that need to take place there, and I don't believe that those were fulfilled in the first century. I still think that there are things that are yet to come. That is what John and some of the Old Testament prophets like Ezekiel, Daniel, Isaiah were talking about when it comes to that day. So also, the 70 weeks of Daniel, that was kind of the one that cinched it for me. If we assume that the 70 weeks of Daniel are 70 weeks of years, seven-year periods that Daniel was talking about, and that 70th week, the 70 weeks are appointed for Your people is what the angel said to Daniel. That the your people presumably means, and notice I'm using the word presume because I could be wrong about that, presumably means the Jews. Therefore, since we're into the church age now, if that 70th week is yet to be fulfilled, and again, acknowledging that we're making some assumptions here, okay, and if these assumptions are wrong, then necessarily the interpretation based on those assumptions is wrong. But if we assume that the 70 weeks are all appointed for the Jews, and that that 70th week is yet in the future, it would seem to indicate that the church will not be here. Now, I assume that those presumptions are true, and so that's how I come to the pre-tribulational view of the rapture. But as I said, God is called the Lord of hosts, Lord of armies, for a reason, and he's not going to give away his plans before it's time. And certainly the enemy, the principalities, powers, rulers of spiritual darkness, would be able to fabricate a really convincing lie if they had more information than what God revealed in Scripture. The apostles who learned directly from Jesus, they didn't understand the prophecies of his first coming. We probably won't understand the prophecies of his second coming any better than they did. We had a wonderful time in Oklahoma recently. It was the Blessed Hope Prophecy Forum, October 13th through 15th. The DVD sets are still available. In fact, I believe you can still sign up for the video stream on through Roku, where you can watch on Roku, I should say. Information about that is at prophecywatchers.com. All of the speakers, there were 32 because at the last minute, one of the speakers had a health issue, and I believe that was Gary Frazier. Had to back out at the last minute. So 32 speakers, but every one of the 32 was featured on the video stream at least once. And so you get to see Sharon's presentation on Jack the Ripper and spiritual warfare in the 19th century. That was a real time of transition as far as the way the spirit realm was interfaced by humanity. My talk in the main room on the last clash of the Titans, which deals with Mystery Babylon, identifying Mystery Babylon and the return of the old gods. And of course, since we're dealing with Mystery Babylon as a future event, again, prophetically speaking, we're looking at a different time scale than what we just discussed with Brian Gadawa. But the War of Gog and Magog, I brought that into the presentation and shared some research that I have to credit to Dr. Michael Heiser for putting me onto this through his excellent podcast and Bible study, the Naked Bible Podcast. Some good stuff when he got to Ezekiel 38 and 39 that I hadn't been aware of. And when I tied it together with some of the research I'd been doing on the ancient Amorites and their practice of ancestor worship, and especially who they identified as their ancestors, it was it was pretty mind-boggling. So anyway, prophecywatchers.com to either get the video stream or to order the DVD set, which will include all of the presentations. So that will be where you find that. Now that we're back home and plan to be for a stretch, we're going to get back to the Gilbert House Fellowship, the Bible study, which we put on hiatus for a couple of weeks there as we prepared for and then attended the Blessed Hope Prophecy Forum. You'll find that posted by midday Sunday at gilberthouse.org. Gilberthouse.org. We're going through the Old Testament now, the book of Isaiah. My novel, The God Conspiracy, available as a free audiobook online. I've posted it through YouTube now, so if you go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, look for the playlist that says The God Conspiracy, 27 parts, I think, altogether. And we are looking at possibly republishing the hard copy, the print copy, in 2018. I'll keep you posted about that. Skywatch TV this month, we're offering some special web-exclusive programs dealing with spiritual warfare. This is leading up to Halloween. So we've got a number of discussions with Josh Peck, with Sharon, with Tom Horn, talking about the nature of the spiritual war in which we find ourselves. This also tied to the release of Tom's new book, Saboteurs, the new book by Carl Gallup's Gods and Thrones, and Colonel Bob McGinnis's new book, The Deeper State. But again, it digs deeper. We also discussed Sharon's new novel, Blood Rites, which is now available, the second book in the Red Wings saga. Blood Lies, book number one. Blood Rights, book number two, now available for pre-order. We should have those in the warehouse within the next week or two. And you'll find these web exclusive programs exclusively on the web at skywatchtv.com, but also the Skywatch TV channels on YouTube, Roku, and Apple TV, also on the Skywatch TV mobile app. We thank you for giving us a review. If you take a moment and just give us as many stars as you feel we deserve at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else fine podcasts are sold, and on Facebook. You'll find our page there, the View from the Bunker page at Facebook, and then give us a like and follow us there. A View from a Bunker. View from the Bunker, production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. The opening announcement by DC Good. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.